Got Dr. Ernst Winder. Dr. Ernst Winder is one of my heroes. That's right. I love to bring you guys my heroes, people who have been such a great influence on me. He's the founder of the American Health Foundation. It's a group of about 300 of the most famous scientists in the world, and they study the relationship between lifestyle, including diet and tobacco use, and cancer. And he's got all kinds of interesting ideas on how to help people regain lost health and prevent disease. And he does it on a worldwide scale. This is such a famous man, such a remarkable man. He even has his own medical journal, Preventive Medicine, and he'll be on tonight. And also Mark Sorensen, who founded the National Institute of Fitness, will be on tonight. That's a place in Ivins, Utah. And it's a great place to go visit. It's a place where you get lots of exercise, you get a good diet. And Mark has been really instrumental in turning the lives of people around. I've had so many people who have come to my clinic at St. Helena Hospital and said they spent some time with with Mark Sorensen and his wife Vicky out at the National Institute of Fitness, and how it changed their life. Got them to exercise, got them to eat well. So he'll be with us tonight. So if you have questions, comments, you'd like to make, I don't know, want a challenging second opinion, then give me a call. The number again is 1-800-556-7125. That's 556-7125. And in the news, I haven't had a chance to get back on my medical journals when I got back, a whole stack of them, and I have this passion of reading scientific journals. Love it. Why do I love it? Well, because the studies support things that I basically believe. You know, I have to tell you, I look at it from that particular point of view. I have a set of beliefs, and that set of beliefs is based on a lot of experience, a lot of education, and I read the scientific journals to help support and enlarge that base of knowledge. I remember one of my heroes again, John Scharfenberg, very famous man from the Adventist Church, Loma Linda University. And he was giving seminars all over the country, still is, gives seminars on how to prevent heart disease. And he gave one seminar in Hawaii when I was there, and we were talking, and I said, well, why do you believe this is true? He says, I believe it's true because it's in the Bible. And I said, well, what do you mean? I thought that was kind of a hokey thing to say. He says, I believe that eating right is true in terms of good health, a vegetarian diet, because it's in the Bible. And I said, well, doesn't the scientific literature count? He says, yeah, if it supports my basic belief. He's a very religious man. Well, I wouldn't go from that point of view. I'd have to say, I believe what I believe because it is part of a foundation of knowledge which I've gained over the years through much experience, and reading the scientific literature must support that point of view or enlarge upon it. If it challenges it, hopefully I will take that into consideration and make that expansion of that fund of knowledge in the direction that is appropriate. Anyways, getting back to the scientific literature, I've had a lot of fun reading my journals, catching up today. One of the interesting pieces of information that came through is from a newsletter called Nutrition and the MD. It's volume 22, August 1996. Now, Nutrition and the MD, I mean, that's almost an oxymoron, isn't it? That's almost a complete contradiction, isn't it? Doctors and food don't seem to go together because we have such little education. Well, this newsletter was put out many years ago. I think I've been getting it for almost a decade, to take and help bridge that gap between doctors' fundamental drug knowledge and surgery knowledge and good eating. And I think it's done a pretty good job. I've always found it an extremely conservative publication, but I think they must be getting more informed in terms of the scientific literature, more enlightened, less biased, because of the article that they published in this August 1996 issue. It's on vegetarian diets. Health implications of vegetarian diets. Vegetarian diets for children. Summary, patients who are interested in vegetarian diets as a dietary alternative should be encouraged by their physicians to do so. Can you believe that? Let me say that again, because it's almost shocking. It's almost a milestone statement. Patients who show an interest in vegetarian diets as a dietary alternative should be encouraged by their physicians to do so. Well, I think so, particularly if you're interested in good health. Well, this is a whole good issue. It's not 100% supportive of what I suggest. They still try and get you into a little bit of dairy products, even though they hedge on it. They say, well, you know, it really isn't necessary. No, it isn't. They're down to really just beating the B12 issue to death. Any of you who have read the books that I've written, you understand that B12 is something that I addressed back in my first book in 1983, made a big issue of it. It is the only nutrient that you can fall short of in terms of the kind of diet I recommend, which is a pure vegetarian diet, no eggs, no dairy, of course, no fish or chicken or beef or pork. B12 is the only criticism you could lodge against it. And so I addressed that back in 1983 in the first book, The McDougal Plan. I've addressed it over and over and over again because I don't want you to have any criticism of an excellent diet. And, of course, the way I addressed it is the same way they address it, and that is to add a non-animal source of B12 to your diet if you're going to be eating a pure vegetarian diet. So you read this carefully, this August 1996 issue of Nutrition and the MD, which you could probably get at the community hospital or one of your local hospitals. Read it carefully, and I think you'll find that basically they're telling you the same thing that I'm telling you and have been telling you for an awful long time. Nice to see progress being made. You know, I think part of it is economics, and I've told you that many times before. I think it's the fact that medicine is being changed as far as its financial incentives go. 20 years ago, when I first started practicing medicine, it was fee-for-service. In other words, the sicker you were, the more money I made. There was no incentive for me at all to get you healthy because I made money from illness. Now, it doesn't mean that I or any other doctor went purposely out to make you sick, but we did profit directly from your sickness. Now, if we were penalized by your sickness, our whole emphasis would be completely different, wouldn't it? If we were penalized by your sickness, what would we do? We take trouble to make sure that you stayed healthy, of course. And that's the way things are these days. We've changed to a managed care system. Capitation is one of the terms that's being bantered around, and capitation means that the patient gets paid per capita, per head. And regardless of how much money the doctor has to spend on your health care, that's all the doctor gets paid. So if the doctor doesn't have to spend any money or little money on your health care, then the doctor gets to keep the money, the per capita, the $40 or $80 that you're paid per month, the doctor's paid per month to have you as a patient. In that case, there's great incentive for you not to get sick and great incentive to teach vegetarian diets, exercise, good health habits. You may find your doctor over at your house tomorrow morning for breakfast to make sure you're eating oatmeal. I'm Dr. John McDougall, and the lines are open if you'd like to call. The number to call is, let's see if I can find it here, 1-800-556-7125. Back with you in just a moment.
For you to ask Dr. John McDougall a question, call now, 1-800-556-7125. That's 1-800-556-7125.
And I'm Dr. John McDougall. Let's go to Los Angeles and say hello to Joe. Joe, welcome to Your Good Health.
Hello, Dr. McDougall. I've enjoyed your diet and have stuck to it. I've tried all the different the foods. The one problem I've had, though, is with the gas, the flatulence.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried some carbon capsules and Beano and things, but I've still had that problem with the gas. Do you have any suggestions for me?
Have you tried leaving the beans alone completely?
Yes.
And that didn't help either?
Still had the problem.
And you don't enjoy the gas?
I still have recurring throughout the day.
Okay. What you can do, Joe, is you can simplify your diet. What you may have is a malabsorption problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one of the ways to work through the malabsorption problem, because, you know, obviously I can't joke with you about this. One of the ways, because you take this very seriously, one of the ways to work through this is to do the elimination diet. Because what it'll do is it'll help you to identify things that you may be malabsorbing. You see, the way you get the gas, excessive gas in particular, is nutrients, particularly carbohydrates, are usually picked up by the small intestine and absorbed into the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
But some people don't absorb certain carbohydrates. And commonly, there are a couple carbohydrates in beans that people don't absorb. And so beans have that reputation for giving people lots of gas. Well, it could be other carbohydrates that you don't absorb. For example, most Asians and blacks and Hispanics do not absorb lactose, which is the carbohydrate in milk. So it goes through the small intestine unabsorbed into the large intestine. Mm-hmm. So we have to assume in your case there's something that you're malabsorbing that's going to the large intestine where the bacteria work on that carbohydrate, and as a result of digesting the carbohydrate, the bacteria make gas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the way we sort out the malabsorption is we put you on a simple diet, and I call this an elimination diet, and it's found in the McDougall program, 12 Days to Dynamic Health. It's found in the McDougall plan. It's found in McDougall's Medicine, A Challenging Second Opinion. So you probably have the elimination diet in one of the books that you have already.
Yes.
Okay, it's a diet of brown rice, sweet potatoes, non-citrus fruits, and green and yellow vegetables, everything cooked very thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you have you're eating the foods that are least likely to cause you indigestion. Now, if that takes care of the gas, which it likely will, minimize the gas, then what you do is you start adding things back to your diet.
Okay.
And you start adding them back one at a time. Of course, if you want to find out, you know, what's most likely to trouble you, you might start with beans or with wheat or corn. And if you instead you want to start out by choosing the foods that are least likely to bother you, you might start with potatoes and sweet potatoes.
Okay.
And in that way, you can kind of sort it out for yourself. But usually, thorough cooking, avoiding beans, peas, and lentils, sprouting beans, peas, and lentils, if you do decide to eat them, using Beano or using activated charcoal usually solves the problems for most people, but didn't for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to take the trouble to do that?
I sure will.
Let me just ask you, have you been on the diet for how long?
I was on for about 15 months.
And how have you done besides the gas?
I felt otherwise everything. I felt healthier. I lost about 10 pounds. Digestion was easier. And all around, I just enjoyed it.
Enjoy the diet. Okay, well, I hope that it helps you sort out what's giving you the gas. You know, there are other things like broccoli that can give you gas. And mm-hmm. So see if by doing the elimination diet that doesn't work out for you, okay?
Okay, great.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
and let's talk to Marcy in Santa Rosa. Marcy, welcome
Hi.
To the show. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've never really, I barely heard of your diet, and I see a lot of your menus in different restaurants that I go to.
Yeah, there are about 100 restaurants in the Santa Rosa area, and you know, if you want a list of those restaurants, you want a booklet, if you stop by my office at WikiUp Professional Center,
mm-hmm.
they'll give you a book for free that lists all the restaurants.
The question that I had to ask you is, I'm not real familiar with the diet and how it works. But I have a son who's got a severe medical condition, which is controlled by diet alone. And basically, what he needs is high carbohydrates. But what happens with children like him, they tend to be excessively overweight. And but that's not true for all. I mean, I believe it's just the foods that you choose.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm just curious. If something like this, I mean, I think it might be worth looking into. I don't know if something like this might work for him.
He needs lots of carbohydrate?
Yeah, he's got a G6 phosphatase deficiency.
So there are certain carbohydrates he can't eat.
He can't have, the certain sugars he can't have are your fructose, sucrose, lactose, and galactose.
Right.
And that's those are the ones he can't have.
So that should be easy for him to keep away from, shouldn't it?
It is now. I mean, now he's not really into that, but...
So except what you would do with the program I recommend, we've already gotten rid of the lactose and the galactose because we use no dairy.
Okay.
And the fructose, you just avoid the fruit and the honey.
Okay.
And basically, you'd feed him a diet of rice and beans and corn, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's basically all carbs. But now, the question I had to ask you is the diet that you offer, is it low in fat?
Very low fat.
Okay.
So they always stay thin.
Yeah, because what happens with these kids is they get high triglycerides, high cholesterol, mm-hmm. and they end up with problems by the time they're 20 years old.
Yeah, but only if they eat a diet high in simple sugars or mixed with fat and meat products.
Okay.
In other words, if they eat like I recommend, which is a starch-based diet with vegetables, and in your case, no fruits, the kids stay trim. They never get heart disease, breast cancer, colon cancer, all the other terrible things.
Yeah, heart disease is kind of the other big one.
Yeah, but they won't if they eat the kind of diet I recommend.
And What is the name of your book? I'd really like to take a look.
Well, I'd start with the McDougal Program, 12 Days to Dynamic Health. And, of course, you want to keep listening to the show every Sunday night from 7 to 9. Thank you very much for calling. I'm Dr. John McDougal. Be back with more information for your good health. Dr. John McDougal here with information for your good health. With me, Dr. Ernst Winder, a man I've known for 20 years, more than 20 years. I think I met Dr. Winder when I was in residency training. It was back in 1976 or 77, just after residency training. I met him in Seattle at a conference on diet and cancer. Do you remember that, Dr. Winder?
Oh, yes.
That's the first time we met, and we had breakfast together, and we had a nice little discussion, and I was honored when you said, well, whatever John orders, I'll take the same thing. Has your diet improved over the last 20 years?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, we're trying to do what we preach, namely eat less fat and more fiber.
Well, you founded the American Health Foundation that back in 1969. You do research with close to 300 scientists on the relationship between diet and lifestyle and cancer and other diseases, and you're a firm believer that people should be eating less meat. Is that right?
Well, we are a firm believer in what I call lifestyle medicine. You know, as you know, we began with our work on smoking and lung cancer, and then when we began to study cancer, colon and breast and prostate, it became quite evident that nutrition, in particular dietary fat, is of etiological significance.
Okay, but does that mean, I mean, you know, back when we talked 20 years ago, you were talking about less red meat and more fruits and vegetables. Have you come to the point where you think that people should seriously think about the V word, vegetarian?
Well, you know, life is, you know, I always say perfection gets in the way of the possible.
Mm.
And so we have, for the general population, we suggest a diet that had about, let's say, 25% fat and 25 grams of fiber. But when we are now involved in a study we're currently doing on breast and prostate cancer patients, and then we're going down to about 15%. And this, of course, can best be established if you cut out meat altogether.
And make it basically a diet like the Japanese that you studied many years ago.
Well, you know, again, it depends on what the patient can do. You know, we're currently involved in a prospective study on patients with breast cancer that are older than 48 with early breast cancer standard treatment, and they're being divided into those that eat a 15% fat against the standard diet. And we're about to do something similar on cancer of the prostate. So when we have already the cancer, then we obviously need to be more strict with the diet than when we talk about the general population.
It always interests me when people say that it's too difficult to eat a healthy diet, takes too much trouble, too inconvenient, when I think how difficult, how inconvenient it would be to die of prostate or lung cancer or breast cancer. I mean, that to me seems like a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, diet, of course, depends how you're raised. You know, I recently come back from Japan, and they're about eating the same kind of diet. I mean, they went up a little bit in fat, but the Japanese children are still much lower in weight than we are. And we, of course, believe that a good diet is something that we begin very early in life. And therefore, as you know, we are very much interested in diet as it relates to children. And as you know, on October the 7th, we have a Child Health Day that was first proclaimed by Calvin Coolidge. And we are kind of celebrating this day by, number one, we're putting out a health report card where we're listing all the risk factors that children have nowadays. And then we have this year, for the first time, a special campaign which says, take time out for a healthy breakfast. That two components to is, I would like every one of your listeners on that Monday morning, October the 7th, to have breakfast with their children, and having a breakfast that is low in fat and high in fiber.
Well, Dr. Ernst Winter, let's give them more information when we come back about how to get involved in a healthy day and a healthy breakfast and to have healthy children. I'm Dr. John McDougal, and I'll be back with more information for your good health. In 1950, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, appeared an article by Dr. Ernst Winder on linking lung cancer and cigarettes, something we all understand today, even though a lot of people don't practice quitting smoking, continue that bad habit. And then he did research in the 1960s on the relationship between diet and colon cancer. And again, some people take advantage of this very important information, but many people still do not. On October 7th, there's Child Health Day. And that's a day Dr. Ernst Winder would like you to pay particular attention to your diet and the diet of your family and your children and have breakfast. Why is breakfast so important for children? Or anybody, I assume.
Well, anybody. First of all, what you eat for breakfast kind of sets what you eat for the rest of the day. Also, we have found that if children have no breakfast at home or if they have a high-fat breakfast, they have a higher cholesterol level than if they have a low-fat breakfast. So I think it's a good way to start. And, of course, the reason we have this concept, take time out for a healthy breakfast, is that I want children to sit down with their parents. And I know it's a weekday, but I like to see whether Americans can, on this one day, which is Child Health Day, that everybody will get up together and maybe a half an hour earlier and have a meal together. And I think this touches on family togetherness as well as on a healthy way to begin a day.
You know, you're touching on a very emotional point, and that is having meals together. That's something that people used to do, but they don't do that so much anymore.
Well, that's correct. It's interesting when I have been talking about this to people across the country, and the publicity that we want to give for this day, we are planning to do across the country. Then a lot of middle-aged people tell me, well, when they were kids, they had always breakfast together or meal together with their parents. But today, this becomes less and less common. We always seem to be so harassed. And I believe that if we just all, at least on this one day in the breakfast, and then maybe this becomes a habit when we begin to do it all the time.
Well, Dr. Winder, are children in this country fatter and sicker, or is it just something that I seem to be observing?
Well, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, adolescents have increased obesity. And there are several reasons for that. For one, we tend to eat more fast food, which generally seems to be fatter. Secondly, we move less, we exercise less in part, because the average kid sits in front of a television 4 hours a day. And then what most of us don't recognize, all these kids are now computer literate, so they sit another 2 hours before the computer, and all the time, the only thing they move is with their hands. So that the combination of excessive intake of fast foods and the decreasing physical activity leads to increasing obesity.
And diabetes.
And then increasing obesity leads to diabetes and leads to heart disease and leads to hypertension. And we, of course, find that obesity begins many times early in life. And something like 75% of obese adults used to be obese children. And we need to learn that a little kid, 2 or 3 years old, that's obese, we say, isn't the kid cute? Well, the kid is already on the way to become obese, and it's much easier to change a kid's eating habits and exercise habits on in life than later when we are adults.
So you're telling me this isn't a genetic problem?
What I'm saying to you that in most instances, clearly, obesity is what results from the equation of eating too much and exercising too little. This is not to say that there are some people who may have a genetic propensity for obesity.
But if they don't eat the wrong foods and they don't fail to get exercise, it'll never come out. Is that correct?
You got that one right. And you know, all you got to do, my wife and I just came back from Japan, and if you stand on the Ginza and you look at all the people who are running up and down the street, you'll find very few obese people in Japan. But of course, when they come to this country and after the second generation, they have about the same cholesterol and the same diseases as we have because they have adapted our dietary habits.
On October 7th, Child Health Day, when you'd like parents and children to sit down together to eat breakfast at least, and maybe to start a trend of eating breakfast and dinner together, and probably not possibly lunch, but certainly breakfast and dinner is what we used to have when I was growing up as a family, we would have together. On that day, what would you encourage the breakfast to be for the family?
Well, the ideal thing is, of course, you have a cereal. You have wheat toast with maybe some jam or honey. You have orange juice. You have low-fat milk. You put some fruits on your cereal, and fruits can give you easily 6 grams of fiber. Or you have a bran cereal, and you can have some bagels. So it's a very complete breakfast that you can have and easily have 6 or 7 grams of fiber and have just maybe a couple of grams of fat.
It sounds like one-third of the diet for the day you're recommending as a vegetarian diet.
Yes, you know, it's a good way to begin. And what I said earlier, if in the morning you get up and you begin to realize what a healthy breakfast is, you know, you are less likely to go out for lunch or for dinner and eat a very high-fat meal. But the other thing, of course, as you and I just emphasized, the family involvement is so important. And, you know, in these days when every politician talks about family values, I say, well, a very good way to begin is having some meals together with your family.
Well, Dr. Ernst Winder, you've been working on this for years, at least 10 years that I know of, to try and get emphasis on good health to children. Are you making any progress? I mean, you had some pamphlets, some booklets for the schools last time we talked. To me, even though you're trying hard, and I'm putting in my efforts, and many other people are, to me, we're losing.
Well, the difficulty is, you know, as you know, we have a Know Your Body program for school health education, and we are now in some 30 states in various types of pilot programs, but in general, you know, health education, which includes, of course, nutrition, is not an integral part of the education that children learn in elementary school, and that's incidentally when we need to begin, and probably we need to begin much earlier, because much of our cognitive and our emotional and behavioral learning we probably do in our first 6 years of life. But locally, you know, we as parents do not spend enough attention to what our children learn in our school system. And if we had good health education and a full-time health education teacher in every one of our elementary schools, we would have a much healthier society.
But that health education teacher would probably be sponsored by the dairy industry or McDonald's.
Well, this health education teacher in the Know Your Body program is sponsored within the Know Your Body program. And I believe that every school, you know, after all, we have all kinds of teachers that are funded by the state or by locally. What I'm saying, that in addition to a math teacher, an English teacher, and a geography teacher, you need to have at least one teacher who is a health coordinator for the entire school. And so this teacher would teach not only the students, but would teach the teachers, would teach the parents. And before you know, you got a whole health community within the school that would also influence the kind of breakfast that's served or the lunch that's served at that school.
But you are an idealist.
Well, you know, every step counts, you know, and if we as a society are, of course, very much concerned now today about health care costs. And as you know, one of my favorite slogans is to help people die young as late in life as possible.
Now you're being a realist when you talk about health care costs.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, in other words, it seems to me that the government that is in particular concerned about health care costs needs to increasingly work with us to see how we can make preventive medicine.
Well, let's find out when we get back a little bit how the government is working in terms of better health, because Dr. Ernst Winder knows he deals with the people who are involved in the power in this country in terms of health care. I'm Dr. John McDougall, and I'll be back with more information for your good health.
For Your Good Health with Dr. John McDougall, we'll return on FM 100 KZST right after these words. you'd like to ask Dr. John McDougall a question, call now 1-800-556-7125. That's 1-800-556-7125.
And on October 7th, we have Child Health Day. But every day is Child Health Day. I mean, because the future of your children depends upon the foundations that you lay, and nobody understands that better than Dr. Ernst Winder, because he's dedicated a good part of his life to try and improve the health of our children through the schools, through educational programs, and now a program that encourages you to sit down and have breakfast with your family, in fact, breakfast and dinner with your family, and to make it a point to make sure your children are eating healthy foods. Dr. Ernst Winder, I remember one time, and this was again about 20 years ago, when somebody asked you how you discovered the association between cigarettes and lung cancer. And at that time, as I recall, nobody could understand the association, and you kind of put it bluntly to them what the association was. Do you recall?
Well, it was as simple as, you know, what we learn in medicine. If you ask the right question, you can make a diagnosis. And we simply went about and asked lung cancer patients a great number of questions about their habits, including smoking, and then compared this to people without lung cancer of the same age and same sex. And after you interview the first 20 cases of lung cancer comparative to control, you know there's a very significant difference, and you notice that lung cancer is very rare indeed in non-smokers.
Yeah,
it was that simple.
Yeah, I know, but as I recall, the way you put it to your doubting colleagues was, look, all you do is have to observe that they stick this thing in their mouth and they suck in smoke and they get cancer. That's not too hard to understand. Didn't you put it something in that way?
Well, what we pointed out that we knew for a long time that if you combust organic matter, you create carcinogens, and obviously you inhale them. And to me, from the very beginning, that this was so obvious that I never understood that that our colleagues were so dubious. And you better believe if they're dubious about that relation those days about smoking and lung cancer, you better believe that they're dubious today about our work in terms of nutrition, which, of course, is far more complicated, though to me, at least, just as clear as the work on lung cancer smoking.
Yeah, you put a cigarette in your mouth and you inhale it and you get lung cancer. You put the spoon in your mouth with unhealthy food and you get cancer of the intestine. Doesn't seem too difficult, does it?
Oh, you particular, you know what I call today, most of our cancers relate to a particular colon, relate to metabolic overload.
Metabolic overload.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell me about that.
Well, metabolic overload, we eat too much fat, and that too much fat in turn influences the bile acids in the stool and the bacterial flora, and these bile acids can be irritating to the mucosa of the colon. Same time, we don't eat enough fiber so that our stool is very dense. And, certainly Dr. Burkett was right years ago when he pointed out that if you eat 20-25 grams of fiber a day, your stool is very fluffy, and you certainly will get less colon cancer, and furthermore, you are not going to be constipated. So it all indicated that nature wants us to have a kind of normal bowel movement that most Americans don't know, because we don't eat enough vegetable fibers.
Right, just walking through the drugstore and seeing all the laxatives and stool softeners for sale would make you think there's a problem, or at least suspect there's a problem. Your group also, the American Health Foundation, believes there's an association between, a causal association between diet and breast cancer. Is that not correct?
That's correct. And, you know, we've done a lot of experimentation that shows that various types of fatty acids, particularly unsaturated fatty acids, seem to enhance tumor progression of breast cancer in the experimental animal. And we believe that this relates also to human breast cancer, particularly postmenopausally. And as I indicated earlier, we are currently involved in a prospective clinical trial where we're testing the effectiveness of a low-fat diet on tumor recurrence.
Yeah, women who already have breast cancer being treated with a low-fat diet, because it
right.
makes no sense to throw gasoline on.
The best way is for everyone to begin the kind of diet that we're all suggesting, certainly very early in life. And then you become used to it. And I, for instance, have given up eating red meat for the past 3 years. And, you know, and after a while, you don't miss it.
Now, you said polyunsaturated fats. These are vegetable oils like safflower and corn oil. How about olive oil?
Well, the olive oil appears to be, for both experimental and studies in epidemiology, less harmful. For instance, we are showing in our animal model, they seem to be relatively neutral. And in terms of breast and prostate and colon cancer in southern Italy and Spain and Greece, even though they consume enormous amount of olive oil, the rates are reasonably low. So it is really the type of fat, and the types of fat are, in our view, both vegetable oils and clearly also saturated fats, like in meat and in butter.
But there's a group in Harvard with Dr. Walter Willett that says that diet has nothing to do with breast cancer. You know about that research.
Yeah, well, naturally we know about this. And this is perhaps too complicated to discuss here, but one of the problems that we have with the kind of studies that Dr. Willett is doing prospectively, or we are doing case-control studies, is that nutritional assessment is quite inaccurate in a homogeneous population.
All right. Well, I just wanted to make sure that you did definitely disagree with what they were saying, because their work discouraged a lot of people. Is there a phone number that people can call if they want to find out more about what you're doing?
Well, our phone number in our office in New York is you can call 914-592-2600.
2600. Thank you very much for being with me, Dr. Ernst Winder. I'm Dr. John McDougall. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
If you'd like to ask Dr. John McDougall a question, call now 1-800-556-7125. That's 1-800-556-7125.
And Dr. John McDougall back with information for your good health. We're going to have time for your questions here coming up 8 o'clock, but then later on in the hour, we're also going to have some time to spend with Mark Sorensen. Been a longtime friend of mine and a wealth of information, so we'll have him on about 8:30 or so. So if you'd like to get into the show, give me a call. Let's see, follow up on 526 women treated at Royal Free Hospital London for heavy bleeding. They did endometrial resections on them. In other words, they took the uterus, the inside line of the uterus out. And as a result of this kind of treatment, only 9% had to undergo a hysterectomy within 5 years. You see, a lot of women have hysterectomies because they bleed excessively. Of course, the cause of that excessive bleeding is the high-fat American diet. But they get into problems of excessive bleeding at the time of period, mid-cycle. And the solution too often has been a hysterectomy in the past. Well, instead, they can just take out the inside lining of the uterus these days, and as a result, they can control the bleeding. They had satisfactory control of bleeding in 80 to 87% of the cases and avoided having surgery. Well, if you have friends or relatives with that kind of problem, you might want to suggest that they look for an alternative besides having their uterus removed. That's a big loss. It really is. And unfortunately, one-third of women, by the time they hit menopause, have had a hysterectomy. 90% of them are avoidable by well-informed women. I'm Dr. John McDougall. We'll be back with more information for your good health.